phrase, "you're welcome," is one that is normally considered a gracious response to a statement of thanks. But in the world depicted by Stephanie Land in her compelling new book, Made, the phrase is used almost as a statement of contempt to those receiving government benefits by those who often have no idea about the circumstances of those recipients. The welfare queen stereotype introduced by Ronald Reagan in 1976 still resonates strongly in this country. Think of Mitt Romney's famous quote from the 2012 campaign about the 47%.
About 40 million Americans received food stamps or SNAP assistance in 2018, a program that cost the United States taxpayers some $60 billion. The stereotypes of welfare recipients, oftentimes thought of as lazily living off of the sweat of others, is simply contradicted by all kinds of data in this area.
Indeed, the reality of life for the working poor is not well understood by Americans who haven't lived it. Stephanie Land's new book, Made, elegantly provides a vivid picture of a not-so-elegant lifestyle. A single mother with few resources and no real family financial safety net, Land is determined to not only provide for her daughter under difficult circumstances, but pursue the education that she hopes will ultimately improve her lifestyle. We are so fortunate to have Stephanie Land with us this morning to discuss her journey, so beautifully described in Made. Stephanie, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stephanie, you grew up in the suburbs, and your mother had a master's degree. Can you help the audience understand how you ended up in the dire straits described in the book?
Sure. I should note that my mom was actually the first person in our family to go to college, so that was, I think, inspiring to me as a child without really knowing it. But I think by the time I was in my mid to late 20s, I decided to go to college on my own. I put it off for a long time because I had to pay for it by myself, and I wanted to make sure I would get the most out of it that I possibly could, and found out I was pregnant, and decided, you know, I'm surrounded by family, and, you know, the father will probably come around at some point, but by the time Mia was 9 months old, we were in a homeless shelter because the relationship was incredibly toxic and left me without any money, and my family couldn't help me or take me in, and so that was where we landed.
So the husband of your daughter Mia was toxic. He had a temper, and one day he punched his hand through a plexiglass window where you guys were living. That got the police involved. And from there, you were able to tap into some public assistance for some help. Talk to us about what a couple of those initial programs were and how they allowed you to leave Mia's father and start off and create a safer environment for your daughter.
Well, first, we were never married, so that kind of added a little bit of complication. Just, I think, in how we were viewed as parents and how especially I was viewed as a mother. So when I started looking for assistance, I went to anybody who was knowledgeable in what resources were out there. One of the first things that I did that was incredibly helpful was I got like a public aid nurse. It was like a home visit nurse that was just through the public health department. And she knew about all of these programs that I could benefit from. And I think it was just finding people like that. I had a domestic violence advocate who acted as a therapist kind of, and she's the one who told me about school scholarships and different grants that I could take. And then just kind of asking around, it was a very small community, and it was just kind of getting on the phone and using whatever minutes I had on my phone and saying like, "Hey, I really need a job. Is there any work that you need done? I will be more than happy to do that." And it just kind of grew from there.
One of the interesting things about the book was it showed how much time, energy, and frankly, smarts it took to navigate your way through all these bureaucracies. I take it there was just no one central source you could go to help you figure out what was available to you.
No, there really isn't, or there wasn't at the time. And that is even worse now, currently. So it used to be that you could go to the, like, Department of Health and Human Services, or in every state, I think it's called something a little bit different, but you could just apply for services or apply for, you know, whatever. And so you could apply for food stamps, Medicaid, sometimes I think even the child care grant. And once you qualify, and TANF, which is cash assistance. And once you qualified for, I think just for SNAP, you automatically qualified for utility assistance and free school lunches and all of these things. So it kind of saved you from having to not only get access to the applications, which required, you know, computer and internet and sometimes even a printer. But they just, once they believed you that you qualified for SNAP, and they believed you that you qualified for everything else. And when that started to go away, it was, you know, I was constantly proving that I not only qualified, but I was working enough to continue to receive it. Any one of those different programs. And that's it's a total waste of time sometimes, because you have to take off an afternoon of work to receive a benefit that totals the amount in wages. But because you took that afternoon off of work, then you're seen as an unreliable employee, and that marks you heavily.
So let's talk about the work that you did while you were going through this. Your book's titled Maid, so it's self-descriptive. You worked as a maid. You cleaned other people's homes. A lot of your book talks about what that experience is like, cleaning people's homes. You talk about a few different people's homes. And it's kind of humorous to get your views of different people's lives and the insights that you got. I think both Roger and I are more interested in your experience and the assistance and how the system works and how maybe it could be better. But let's take a minute and talk to us about one or two of the homes. This is kind of a family show here, so there's one house that we probably shouldn't talk about. But pick two of your favorite homes and tell us about that and the insights you got from working there.
Well, I mean, the first one that comes to mind is I had a client that I ended up calling Henry, and he was always home. And his house was incredibly difficult, and I was intimidated by him at first because I'm sorry, I'm getting over a chest cold. He had so many cleaners before me and was never really happy with them. And so I was kind of like the company's last chance at keeping this client. And I went in there knowing this, and my manager at the time was with me, and she's like, oh, she's our hardest worker. She's our best one. And so I think I worked in Henry's house for over a year, maybe it was only 9 months or so, but and by the end of my time with him, he was calling me like the hardest worker, and I think that was the first time that my work was actually seen and recognized, and that somebody saw like what a difficult job it is to go into this, you know, pretty huge house, or to me it was really huge, and mop the whole thing, like wipe everything down, get everything done on the list in just 4 hours. And for his house, like I was sweating. And he saw that and he recognized it, and he kind of congratulated me on it. And I earned his respect in that way. And that really stuck out to me, because in a lot of my other houses, I never saw the homeowner. And I don't think they would even recognize me or even knew my name. To them, I was just, you know, something that happened on Wednesday. And my job was to go in there and not only be invisible, but to erase all signs that I had been there, but also while obviously showing that I had been there. It was a weird existence.
Yeah, one of the strange things about the book and the whole job that you talked about was this notion that while the work is very physically demanding and very difficult, many of the customers, particularly when you're working with the agency, really didn't acknowledge your existence. And therefore, it was very hard, I take it, to get satisfaction from the job when no one's going to recognize it at all.
Yeah, I mean, looking back, someone asked me at one of my readings if there was anything that I missed about being a maid. And I had to think about it. And I was like, you know what? Like, going in and finishing a job and seeing immediate results and doing that in just a matter of hours was pretty satisfying. Like, it, you know, in comparison, my job now, like, I technically started working before I even got out of bed this morning and was working up until late last night because, you know, the emails never really stop and I have to force myself to not engage with work most of the time. And it feels like it's never ending. And it was kind of a satisfying thing to just like clock out and be done and go home. So there is that aspect to it that I appreciated, I guess. But it was also incredibly boring, and I was very isolated and very alone, and going through some like momentous, like really hard times, and had nobody to really talk to about it. And so I think I developed this like extreme sort of PTSD, but also did everything I could to prevent like kind of like breaking down from the emotions and the weight that I was carrying.
Yeah, no, that comes through in your book. You know, the reader finds themselves rooting for you, and they can really feel the weight that is on your shoulders, not only as a low-income employer, but employee, but as a mom. And fortunately, the story has a happy ending, which we'll get to towards the end of our interview. But I want to follow up on Roger's question. He talked about the invisibleness of being a maid. You go into somebody's house when they're gone, you clean, you leave before they come back. But there, you also talk about, in your book, the invisibleness of being poor. Talk to us about that, how it felt, and why you think society is that way.
Well, I feel like it's a defense mechanism. You know, that's kind of why we think of them as those people, or like I'm putting out my arm and like, you know, bracing myself kind of in this like motion of, you know, we push poor people down into this place that we feel we will never be in. And we do that by saying, like, I hear it all the time, like, oh, because I had a child out of wedlock, and because I didn't go to college in my early 20s, because I didn't set up all of these like financial pathways that would set me up properly for having a child, because this person didn't do that, and they did everything quote unquote right, then they will never be in my position and they don't have to worry about that. Because poverty is a really scary thing to imagine. I mean, imagine losing your home and having to live with your family in a car and so I think we're scared of that happening to us. And so we not only put all of these bad decisions on poor people and say things like, oh, well, they just don't know how to budget money, or, you know, they don't know how to better their lives, or they just don't get it. We say all these things because then they brought it on themselves. And there's a side to that that is, if they brought it on themselves, then we don't need to feel the need to help them, because, you know, they made their beds and now they have to lie in it.
And what's your view on that?
I think, you know, we're ignoring the fact that there are sometimes dozens of people a day who invisibly make your life better in direct and indirect ways. Like if you, you know, when I was on book tour, I started talking about this a lot. Like, so I woke up in a hotel this morning. I had to check out. I ate breakfast. I had to fly somewhere. I had to check into another hotel and had a cab driver drive me, went out to eat again. And then by the end of the day, there are dozens of people whose job is to make my life easier. And we are not only not recognizing that, but we're not seeing that these people are most of the time getting paid minimum wage, which it's impossible to support even yourself as a single person on minimum wage, let alone a family. And we completely ignore that. And the more I talk about how the minimum wage needs to be higher, I get comments like, well, the minimum wage isn't supposed to support people. It's not supposed to support families. It's supposed to be for entry-level, like, teenager jobs. But, you know, most people on minimum wage are having to work those entry-level jobs. And it's not, it's no longer a job that you get in high school. It's a job that you raise your family on.
It's interesting you say that. As I came in this morning getting ready for this interview, I saw someone shoveling the snow as I was walking into the station and thought, wow, that's a job that people probably don't notice because, again, the book had sensitized me to that issue. One of the questions I had, though, going back to the sort of financial programs is, you know, 30 years ago when I was an economics student, they talked a lot about how social welfare programs needed to avoid disincentivizing people from increasing their incomes. In other words, that they had to be structured in a way to try to help people work their way out. Talk to us a little bit about your perception of whether the various assistance programs you had discouraged more work, encouraged more work, or were structured appropriately or inappropriately.
Well, I think there's a lot to kind of unpack with that.
Yep.
So there's Paul Ryan and even Bill Clinton really enjoyed using the term welfare to work. And that was based on the assumption that people are sitting around and getting welfare and not working. When really, you know, it's more than half at least. I think it goes between like 50% and 70% of the people who are using food stamps and using food banks are working families. And it is truly a supplemental program in that aspect. But most people who are using food benefits, that is their main source of food. It was for me, at least. Like, that was the only money that I had for food. But there's also, I think this, I don't know, I think poor people are degraded so much. They are pushed down. They are treated so poorly that they don't even try. And there are, you know, there are a lot of things with that, like, oh, no, I don't even want to try for the manager position. Like, I don't even think that I could do that. I've heard that before. I think we're kind of taught to be content and be happy with the job that we have because anything else is too big of a risk. But, I mean, there's also a part of the government assistance programs, especially the safety net programs, which – you know, it's only like 9% of the tax budget. But there's a thing called a welfare cliff. And in jumping off of that cliff, a single mother with one child would have to go from $10 an hour receiving benefits to, I think, $33 an hour to make up for the benefits that she was receiving. And that's, you know, Medicaid, child care, possibly housing. And food and anything else. So it's an impossible leap. And what happens is when you get up to the edge of that cliff, sometimes you can go over it with just a 50-cent hour raise. And so 50 cents an hour more a month would normally be a really good thing. But for some people, that means that they no longer qualify for a child care assistance grant. And so suddenly they're left with this, you know, $700 hole in their budget when all they got was 50 cents more an hour.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Stephanie Land. She is the author of the book Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie, you talk in your book about your life situation, what it was like being a single mom, the stress of you're always rushing from one place to the next, the stress of making it all come together. And you know, there are folks, and I think we mentioned in the opening, that think of welfare as, you know, people are lazy, and certainly, excuse me, I guess I have a little bit of a chest cold myself. Certainly in your case, you know, you were really doing everything you could to keep all the pieces together. And this was a way to make your life really just a little bit easier, just a little bit more manageable, just a little more doable. What do you think your life would have been like? Could you have made it if there weren't these government programs to help out?
Oh, man. I don't even know. I mean, there's no way that I would have been able to afford childcare. And I couldn't just hand Mia off to grandma and go to work. Like, I didn't have that availability. You know, later on, after I had a college degree, I freelanced. I was a freelance writer, and I was able to do that with my youngest daughter nursing in my lap and kind of found a way to work from home, because I still couldn't afford childcare at that point either. And so I don't know. I mean, there are so many things that missing a couple of hours of work could possibly mean not paying the electric bill. And we live on that brink. So every single little tiny bit of government assistance that I received was used to its maximum amount, including, you know, getting the most calories out of every dollar of food stamps. You know, we couldn't really afford to get the nicer food. And so I can't even imagine what it would have been like.
That's having read your book, having read your story. That's my take as well. We need to start wrapping up. Your story does have a happy ending. As you mentioned, you end up going to school. You went to school in a town not that dissimilar from Park City, as I heard you describe Missoula, Montana, where the people are friendly, folks say hello. Prior to interviewing you, we just had our mayor of our small town in here, and one of his initiatives is love your town and be kind to one another. And I really like that theme. And as I heard you describe where you moved to, it reminded me a lot of Park City. But I guess my final question, Roger may have one more before we go to break. But when you moved to Missoula, Mia was 5 years old, and you graduated from college 2 years later. So it was a 5 to 8 year journey from the time you found yourself in this situation until you were in a place where you didn't need government assistance. Having lived that experience, what advice do you have for other people where maybe they can get through that difficult period in a shorter period of time?
I tell people to reach out and ask for help, but I don't know if I would have taken that same advice. I think the more we share our stories of struggling, then the less shameful it will be. I think the more we're open about how hard it is to make ends meet, you know, how we might not be able to pay bills this month, how our paycheck was a little bit less, how our taxes that we're owing this year are a little bit more, and what a hardship that places on us. I think just from a community aspect, we might be able to start caring about each other a little bit more and start empathizing with each other. I think a lot of the reasons why my story is popular is because I am, you know, a quote-unquote success story, or I am out of that situation, and I am educated, and I can speak articulately, and I'm white, and I'm very plain-faced, and I look like them. We don't like to hear stories from people who are people of color, who are still struggling, who are angry, and I think that's kind of an important part in this, and I'm hoping that because people are listening to my story, that they might start listening to others as well and empathize with people in way more adverse situations.
Well, Stephanie, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. I do want to just share with you briefly. I found myself really rooting for you and being grateful that the a couple of the folks in your story were there to help you, Kurt. And it sounds like your caseworker, Julie, was also was a godsend for you. Our guest this morning has been Stephanie Land. She is the author of the book Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thank you for having me.